Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable. We're going to talk a lot about the Civil War this morning as the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War approaches. Coming up a little bit later on, we'll be talking to historians William Davis, Jonathan Horn, Don Doyle, and Karen Abbott. First, we welcome Brian Matthew Jordan. His new book is Marching Home, Union Veterans and Their Unending Civil War. His book begins where most Civil War histories come to a close. It recounts the sad reality that awaited Union soldiers 150 years ago when they encountered a nation all too eager to forget and return to communities terribly ill-equipped for their homecoming. Brian Matthew Jordan is a Civil War scholar and lecturer at Gettysburg College and provides a counterpoint to the usual post-war narrative dominated by the Confederate loss and the South's shared sense of defeat. In the North, however, triumph did not necessarily come to the victors, as veterans there stood as unwelcome reminders to a new America fatigued by war and looking toward the prosperity of the Gilded Age. It's a great pleasure to welcome Brian Matthew Jordan to the program. Brian, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, Joe, thanks so much for having me.
Very nice to have you here and to have you help us kick off our next 2 hours here as we dig into the Civil War and talk about this issue. What brought you to the idea of finding out a little bit more of the story? Because as I mentioned in the introduction, and as you mentioned in your introduction to the book, that your story begins where most ends, on those days after Appomattox, where when the soldiers come home, what brought you in that direction?
Well, I tell you, the story really began 15 years ago when, as a young Civil War buff growing up in Akron, Ohio, I met a man in my town who spent his own childhood crisscrossing the Midwest in search of some of the last survivors of Lincoln's armies. The last Union veteran, believe it or not, died in August of 1956 at the age of 109. And this man that I knew very well growing up had spent a lot of time with that last veteran, Albert Wilson, who lived up in Duluth, Minnesota. And the stories that he told me about, those old wrinkled soldiers puffing on fat cigars just made the Civil War real and immediate for me. And he shared with me on one occasion that, you know, there was an aura about these men, that one got the sense that they never really put the war behind them. And that haunting remark just stayed with me, and as I, you know, started on my scholarly career, I realized that, you know, we as historians really didn't know Union veterans. They were caricatures to us. We'd kind of, as a scholarly community, suggested that these men had slipped into civilian life with great ease, that, they entered this period of hibernation after the war. They'd actively suppressed the war's memory. And I wanted to really challenge that. And I really wanted to get to know these men because I was envious of Mr. Dillon, the man that I knew, who got to spend so much time with these characters. So it really started all the way back in Ohio 15 years ago.
You say that Northerners were willing to salute the heroism of Union soldiers, but they remained terribly ill-equipped to mitigate the challenges of their homecoming. How so?
Well, Northern civilians really wanted to embrace the spirit of sectional reconciliation. They were wearied of a war that had grown in scope and scale beyond what anyone could have imagined. I mean, no one could predict what was going to happen at Gettysburg or the Wilderness. And they wanted to move quickly beyond that, those painful memories. They wanted to look toward the freewheeling bounty of the Gilded Age. And sadly, they had, you know, very little sympathy for the plight of the former slave, which, of course, had become Billy Yank's cause by the end of the war. So they wanted to look forward. Union veterans, on the other hand, you know, they needed to shape a narrative. They needed to craft a story to help them cope with this process and make sense of all of the loss and the suffering that they had experienced. And this creates a key tension in those years and decades immediately after the war that shows that, you know, this story of how we've wrestled with the Civil War was never neat or linear or inevitable.
When you look at the Northerners or the soldiers themselves, give us an idea of what they were facing and the ordeal and the length of time of what they were dealing with over time. Because as you indicate in the book, as expected from someone returning to war, this was not something that was a snap of the fingers.
That's right. This is a staggering litany of physical, psychological, and emotional scars. At least 25,000 men returned north having missing an arm or missing a leg. A million and a half men will be wounded in this war, all told. They come back, and those wounds become ready-made metaphors for what they feel is the unfinished work of the war, what Lincoln here in Gettysburg calls the unfinished work of the war. They also believe, and I think rather self-effacingly, that their military triumph on the battlefield had neither settled the war's central issues nor resolved the ultimate fate of the Union. And so there's a psychological burden there, too, that, you know, what we've fought and suffered for over these last 4 years, it's up for grabs. And, you know, when they come home and they find civilians kind of coddling their former enemies and kind of embracing, again, the spirit of sectional reconciliation, that only exacerbates the physical and the psychological pain. And this is a process that continues well into the 20th century. You know, one of my favorite examples of this is the case of Osmond Williams, who is a veteran from northern Vermont. Comes back and one evening in 1874 awakes to a choking sensation and finally coughs up the bullet that lodged in his left lung at Savage's Station. I mean, any notion that, you know, the finality of surrender or the glinting bayonets of the victory parade ended this conflict are simply foolish.
Mm. As we talked about, you know, here is a country that is looking toward the prosperity of the Gilded Age, but obviously hindsight is 20/20. So how aware were they or hopeful that there would be a Gilded Age?
Well, they were hopeful, and I think veterans were not unilaterally opposed to reconciliation, but what they wanted was a measured reconciliation, and they wanted a reconciliation in a country that would recognize their services, that would recognize the personal costs of the war, but also its political results. And they stunningly, and this was something of a surprise to me, they also advanced positions on civil rights that were far in advance of their pre-war selves and certainly post-war civilian society. They were not opposed to a Gilded Age. They were not opposed to reconciliation, but they wanted to make sure that there was a specific kind of reconciliation and kind of union that they had fought for. That was extraordinarily important to them.
The reintegration into citizen life, were there spots in the country where soldiers were more successful than others?
Really, I mean, it's a universal experience, and I found, I researched in every northern state archive and down onto the ground level and local archives, and I found a stunning kind of uniformity of experience. That, you know, the problems of reintegration, especially psychologically, especially feeling as though they were not being taken seriously, feeling as though they didn't have the kind of cultural space to share their narrative, that was rather uniform. Now, that's not to say that in some major metropolitan areas like New York City and Philadelphia that there weren't soldiers' friends, so-called, that were reaching out and helping them. In New York City, Vincent Collier and William Oland Byrne, two wartime philanthropists who had volunteered in Civil War hospitals, and they actually did laudable work to help veterans reintegrate. William Oland Byrne started a newspaper for soldiers who had lost their arms in battle and hired them exclusively to retail the paper. But they were kind of lone voices in the wilderness. most Americans, again, this is an age of laissez-faire individualism. It is an age that that too believes that these soldiers have been morally tainted by the experience of the Civil War. They're not able, and they don't yet have the ability, as perhaps we do today, to suggest that, you know, the war created many of these post-war problems. They were much more eager to attribute those problems of reintegration to personal character flaws.
When you think of the 150 years that has passed since the end of the Civil War, have, and I ask this question somewhat rhetorically because I think we know the answer, but what did we learn from it? I mean, were there lessons learned down the road to better equip ourselves post-war? And what have we, what it was there a, because it seems that just that we've repeated the mistake.
Well, I'll give you the typical historian's answer, which is yes, we've learned, and no, we haven't.
Right.
I think what the Civil War does, and I think Union veterans, and one of the important contributions I hope the book will make, is to see Union veterans as really forging a nascent and novel ideology of veterans' rights. It really emerges in the pages of their veterans' newspapers in the 1870s and 1880s. They want to articulate and explain to the federal government that their military service has opened a contract for the rest of their lives, that you know, he should be cared for by the government and his widow and orphan, as Lincoln said in the second inaugural. That ideology is not at once accepted by the government. It's a slow process. Pension legislation is the best example of that. It gradually liberalizes over the course of the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. But veterans put it on the table. Union veterans put it on the table so that by the time we reach World War I, the country is at least ideologically or infrastructurally perhaps more willing to at least recognize the return of soldiers as a problem. In fact, there's a lot of editorial commentary immediately after the First World War that harkens back to the Civil War problem, that refers to this so-called problem of the pensioner, saying, you know, we need to avoid the Civil War experience, and we need to be mindful of what happened and how we treated Billy Yank when he came marching home, and let's avoid that experience. Of course, you know, we're still contending with these issues today because it's, you know, returning veterans are always subject to the given historical moment and subject to historical context and debates about the war, right? For, you know, veterans are always, you know, flashpoints in how we negotiate the meaning of a war. And Union veterans found themselves in the crosshairs of that. And again, I hope marching home shows that there are social consequences to the ways we tell stories about war.
The name of the book is Coming Home, Marching Home, Union Veterans and Their Upending Civil War. Marching Home is the title. It is published by LiveWrite. And Brian Matthew Jordan, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Coming up next, Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac, and then we'll continue talking about the Civil War and the 150th anniversary of its end. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.